Good evening. I'm a little blitzed out this evening. Anybody else go to see the Dalai Lama? It's just to be with so many people is such an amazing experience. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people.
Thousands.
It must have been thousands.
11,000?
Oh my God.
Yeah. I think that was, there were empty seats.
Not very many, though.
I know.
It was packed.
It was. And if you look down the hall, you could just see everything going like this for an hour. It was like a cartoon, only it was real live human people doing it. It was just amazing. And a very beautiful teaching. Really very simple and very heartfelt and timely. Ancient and timely, both. How to deal with difficulty, how not to succumb to what he called our savage self. He said everyone is a savage, an animal, and we have to learn how to be a wise savage. He said you can't make it go away, but you can work on it and get to know what your life is and what your tendencies are and become so familiar that you can deal with it. So when you meet someone who calls up the savage in you, you don't have to go there. You don't have to punch somebody in the nose. You can be more clever and use your goodwill and your wits to deal with a situation rather than just sheer instinct. Only he said it much better than that. I really, really didn't want to go. And I was so glad I did go. So, even though Michael and I were wandering around totally lost a lot, I asked if he would go with me because I didn't want to go all by myself. He didn't want to go alone either. So, these two Zen brown robes wandering up and down the hall saying, where are we supposed to go? What are we supposed to be doing? Was very funny.
Did you go to the thing afterwards?
No, I didn't. Did you? No, we had tickets for it. We were encouraged to go, but we were both so exhausted, which is really, it was enough. The one afterward was an ecumenical thing. The whole thing was really about bringing all the religions of the at least the South and Mid-Bay Area into one space together. It was the Tibetan group and a number of people in other religious groups that created this whole thing. So that I sat next to a Rinpoche on one side and a black minister on the other side, and on the other side of him was a rabbi. And there were Sikhs and I have no idea, lots and lots of different kinds of religious leaders who were all there, as well as lots and lots of Tibetan red robes, lots and lots of those darling little nuns and monks, and then Chinese nuns and it was a lovely combination of everything. But the idea was to bring all the religious leaders together after the Dalai Lama's talk and talk about ecumenical movement in this area. So that's Wendy and I went to a meeting about that here once, and some of the same people who were here were there. And Michael and I were agreeing that we both feel we have our hands full just doing what we're doing, and to try to take that on also just seems like too much. So I'm kind of leaving it to other people to carry it on if it's going to be carried on. But it seems like a real good idea, because a lot of the real difficulty that comes is from religions misunderstanding each other and beginning to create idealistic attacks on each other, that, like the Shiites and the Sunnis, which is a radical example, but we've seen it all through history, and we can't afford to do that anymore as human beings. The world is too small, and that savage in us is eager to do it sometimes when it's pressed. So it's important. So the interesting thing is that the Genjo Koan is the same subject, really. And so it was kind of refreshing to have the whole thing started before it even started. I have copies of it for anybody. This is Okamura's translation for anybody who, So if anybody needs a copy, this is from Okamura's book, and it's his translation. So the first thing to know is what Genjo Koan means. It's the basis of all of Dogen's teaching, really. It's the essence of it. This is one of the very first things that he ever wrote. He wrote it for a lay person, not for monks. And he put it at the very beginning of Shobo Genzo when he was accumulating all of his writings. He made it the first thing. So if you look it up in the various translations, you'll find different translations of it, but it's the same Genjo Koan. There are a lot of translations of the meaning. Takahashi calls it the actuality of instruction. Abe calls it spontaneous manifestation of true suchness. It's kind of woo-woo. Cook calls it the manifest as absolute reality. Nishijima calls it the realized universe. Tanahashi calls it actualizing the fundamental point. Uchiyama calls it actualization of reality. Now, all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, those are 7 different translations that are available to us if you're interested, and I'm sure there are a great many more. But you can see how various those the expressions are. The actualization of reality is what Uchiyama Roshi calls it. Gen means to be present, or to appear, or that something becomes actual, so that somebody at the other side of the door walks in and becomes present. That's what Gen is. So it has an action part of it and a very visceral right here, right now feeling. It's this. And Jo means to become. or to become complete, or to accomplish. So you could say it's to accomplish coming in the door and being right here now. Something like that. To appear and become present in the real moment of itself as it is. So that's genjo. To appear and to become present. It can also, as a verb, mean to manifest or to actualize. So even though there's the potential of being on the other side of the door, it's not real until it comes inside. It's actualized. Ko, on, we think we know because we hear about koans and we read them all the time because they're Rinzai practice, the stories that bring up various aspects of the Dharma in a kind of challenging way, so that they're not explicit. They're ways of exposing a student to to the various depths and levels and moments of the Dharma, the very many different dynamics that go into understanding one's life in terms of the Dharma. So that in Rinzai practice, you are given one koan a moment until you've solved it, and you live with it until finally your teacher is satisfied that you're okay with it. And then you're given another one, and there are hundreds of them. So it's a many years long practice to study koans. And you meet over and over with your teacher, and you're tested constantly, and you're kind of, sometimes it's kind of a torture, trying to not get caught with the intellectual side of it, and still stay with it, because it's words and ideas. It's difficult and very paradoxical, as life is, of course. So that the most famous one, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the question is asked of a master, and the master says moo. And in one of the koans, it's interpreted as no. Moo means no. And in another, same story, the master says it means yes. So it leaves you with the whole kit and caboodle in your lap in a way that you can't deal with intellectually. And so it's a different, very different kind of training from what we do. But it's also Buddhism. It's also Zen. It's not the koan that Dogen is talking about in Genjo koan. This is about the equality of all things in a public sense. It's how everything, it's how we want justice for everyone and to be fair. That's ko. It's to be, it originally meant an official report, something that was posted up on a bulletin board somewhere, a record of things that happened in old China. But it means to now, in Dogen's words, to equalize inequality, to bring everything onto the same page, we would say. And the an means a particular case, a particular individual, unique thing. So suddenly we have something very interesting. We have the individual, and also we have the equality. So it's another way of talking about our endless paradoxical question about how we are as perfectly each unique individual beings, and yet we all belong together in some very seamless being that is also us. How can that be? And yet that's our experience when we really begin to look deeply into our life as a self. What does it mean to be a self? It begins to appear to us that everything is involved as our self. There isn't any unique individual self without everyone else being involved. So it's called in Zen the two truths. The independence of things, independence of each one of us, and then the seamless whole of all of us. Two truths. One provisional truth, which is the individuality, which is always changing, which is always fading away, as we know. We talk about my individual life, but actually it's just a kind of fib or an illusion, because it's constantly changing. It isn't one thing, and it's only here for that long. It came, it's going to go, it won't even be remembered. It's just a flash in the pan. And yet, so precious, right now, right here. So, Dogen says that reality taking place right now, the Genjo part, is absolute truth, ultimate reality. And that's what Buddha saw under the tree. He saw the thing itself, what's taking place right now under the tree, was also the whole thing. That there was no separation. So Dogen goes on with that, though. He says that the koan, the absolute truth, is reality taking place. It goes the other way around, that the absolute is the reality that's happening now. And it happens in action, our action. It's not some passive sort of idea that we think, oh, I see it all and it's all a union or something like that. It's that what we do is it. So to actualize the Genjo, to actualize the unity, we're the intermediary in between those two, or they meet in our life is the meeting place of the absolute and the relative. And so how do we understand that? That's the subject of the Genjo Koan, how we understand how this could be. And it all rests on our understanding of the self. How do we understand what it is to be a self? So he begins with three statements. When all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings. That's Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching. There's delusion and realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings. So there's a practice that we have in our understanding of what it is to be a living being among all. The second one is when the 10,000 dharmas are without a fixed self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddhas, and no living beings, no birth and no death. So that's the Heart Sutra side, the Prajnaparamita side. Those no's are really important in the teaching, because otherwise the teaching becomes a fixed thing and we get stuck in it. So Mahayana came along and said, well, yes, of course, Buddha's teaching is true, but no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, etc. That we have to let go even of the teaching in order to actualize the present actual moment that we're living. That if we get stuck anywhere, that everything doesn't work anymore. Then the third one is, since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond the dichotomy of abundance and deficiency, there is arising and perishing, delusion and realization, living beings and Buddha. In other words, if we're really living in action right here, it's just like it is. There's no ideal place to be. It's just this place to be. Therefore, flowers fall even though we love them, and weeds grow even though we dislike them. So I'll talk about number four next week, but as you can see, he brings up the whole subject right away and then goes on to talk about what it is to be a living being and what it is to be a self. So number six on the next page, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, etc., is one of the most famous things that Dogen ever said or wrote. And it's the most cogent as far as trying to understand what it is to be this mysterious action, life, breath, blood thing that we are. So there's time for a little talk. Questions? Well, I'd seen him three times in three different, completely different situations. The first one in San Jose at the university, in an even bigger space with even more people. It was huge. And then I saw him at Spirit Rock at a teacher's meeting where there were hardly any people there. And then I saw him again in India by accident, one of those fortuitous accidents where somebody said, oh, Dalai Lama's in town, do you want to go see him? And he was teaching in this little village in the town square. And people had come out of the Himalayas from all their villages, all dressed up with, you know, yarn and gold in their braids and beautiful clothes, and little kids and monks and nuns, hundreds of people all sitting in the dirt in the town square. And every day he taught one of the paramitas. And every day I went down with my little nun and my friend Tinley and sat in the dirt and listened to the Dalai Lama teach. So I thought, oh, you know, it's greedy to want to go another time. I've seen the Dalai Lama. It's fine. And then Mark, Gonerman, who was one of the organizers, invited me and Michael and offered us the opportunity to sit on the stage with all the Sangha, they're called, all the ordained people. And so Mike and I looked at each other and we thought, well, maybe we should. You know, it's kind of an obligation. And then it got kind of exciting. And so I'm glad I went. But it's so many people, it just... it's wonderful to be in that presence of so many who are sort of already there. It feels sort of like the Maharishi wanted to lift up the Pentagon with the energy of everybody many years ago. And it kind of felt like that. It was that kind of energy, that the same intention. Me too.
So I didn't want to go either. And it's kind of funny because Sally was there.
Yes.
She was like, are you going to go? I'm like, I don't like crowds. I don't like going places where everyone's like famous and I don't want to go. And I'm like, well, you want to go? And then yesterday, a friend called me yesterday morning. She's like, I have an extra ticket. No, she left me a message. And I called her right back and I was like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But I've never seen him, and it was pretty cool. I'm exhausted from the crowd, but it was a pretty cool thing.
It was
pretty cool to see who was there.
Yes.
All kinds of people.
Yes.
And it was calm, though.
It was very calm.
People were there to hear him speak.
Yes.
You know, they weren't there for any other reason.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool, and the teachings were like our teachings. Well, that was cool. He's funny.
He is funny. He's just so relaxed and so natural. Yeah, he's very charming and, yeah.
Yeah, I still have to digest it all. Yeah, I've never done anything like that. Never had any desire to. But it was right here.
Yes. Yes. Right down the street. Yeah.
And I knew you, and also I knew you were going to be there, so I think that's also why. Well, Angie's there. I
want to
do this.
Good.
Is she here?
No. I couldn't tell you. I watched the whole thing on the screen.
Yeah.
I saw it in the Shoreline Amphitheater a long time ago. It must have been, was it the 90s? Or, it was a long time ago. Was it really?
Yes.
You know, one thing I felt about him is there's only two people who have made that intense of an impression. The one was Suzuki Roshi. And it wasn't really always just about what they said, although that was certainly remarkable, but just the way they work.
Yes. Yeah.
He's just so natural. He's just everything he says is so focused or just with exact. Mm-hmm. He's just doing what he's doing. Mm-hmm. I feel he teaches by that example as much as anything. Which is what I thought about Suzuki Roshi also.
Yeah.
A few times I saw him since then. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gets down to just being right with this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots and lots of Tibetan people there. Little kids, all dressed up in Tibetan clothes. Men with felt hats that sat on top of their heads, and little girls with little stripy skinny dresses, and running around and playing tag, and beautiful women. Every single Tibetan woman is gorgeous. I don't know why, but they're all so pretty. Michael and I sat, there was a little sort of outside place with a bunch of very shady trees, and there were families sitting out there having lunch, picnics, you know, circles of families of Tibetans only. And so we kind of sneaked in there and had our picnic out there too with all of them, the children playing tag all around us. It was very fun. Made me feel like I was back in India again.
Yeah, it was exhausting. But it was a little hard to follow him and anticipate. Fortunately, he talks a lot with his hands. Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. Angie told me to go. So I went. I didn't have to go. Yeah, it was interesting. It was just too big to feel any kind of presence. We were in the back, and all of those rooms. I couldn't see him, he was like that tall.
Far away. A lot of
colors. Very, very colorful. Oh, yes, bright reds and golds, and yeah, lots of little lamps and flowers and fruits, and everything was up there. Yeah, and afterwards, when everybody cleared out, many people, Tibetan practitioners, went up and sort of hung around the empty stage and the empty seat, I guess you would call it, very high seat that he sat on, and sort of getting the emanations from it. And then they were doing full prostrations, you know, the Tibetan prostrations where they just slide out flat on their faces and then come back up again many, many times. It's like there was this whole devotional side of it that was very different from Zen. I felt kind of austere when I saw that, kind of. You know, they had this outpouring of emotion about the Dalai Lama that we didn't have at all.
Did they burn any incense?
No, but they had little candles. And I don't think they were butter lamps. I don't think they had any butter lamps. There may have been some restriction with the convention center, because it wasn't exactly like in India, you know, in a Gompa in India at all. But they did the best they could with what they had. Well, it's 8 o'clock.